Welcome and good afternoon. I'm Fairfax Doran, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Ballroom Marfa. I'm grateful to Tim Johnson and Caitlin Murray of the Marfa Book Company for not only being amazing partners with the Marfa Dialogues, but also for having and sharing the most unique and amazing bookstore in our country. I don't think there's anything else like this. Also want to thank the Marfa Public Radio for being so relentless with broadcasting live all of the discussions. And I'm very grateful, you know, to Marfa Public Radio for being our media sponsors as well. Before we start, I want to remind everyone we will conclude the Marfa Dialogues with what will be an extraordinary performance with Cynthia Hopkins this evening at the Crowley Theater at 8 p.m. Hope you all can be there. As we plotted the Marfa Dialogues, we wanted the last discussion to focus on solutions to the climate crisis. And one being is realizing and investing in a low carbon economy. David Buckland, founder of Kate Farewell, founder and director of Kate Farewell, and curator of Carbon 13, turn our attention to Tom Rand. To simply put, Tom Rand's bio is very impressive. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering, a Master's in Science, and a Master's and Doctorate in Philosophy. Tom committed his life full time in addressing climate change as a venture capitalist and founder of BCI Green Funds after 2005 when he sold his global telecommunications company. He currently serves on the board of Buckland's Kate Farewell. He's an author of Kick the Fossil Fuel Habit and Hot Water, and is also the lead clean tech advisor for the Mars Discovering District in Toronto, where he helps bridge the world of science, innovation, and business. He is here today to show us how we can kick that fossil fuel habit. Please join me in welcoming Tom Rand. Thank you.
Thanks, Fairfax. It's a real pleasure to be part of these Marfa Dialogues, particularly as someone who's engaged predominantly in the business side of clean tech. It's refreshing to be exposed to conversations both on and off stage that are multi-layered, right? This is a multi-layered problem, multivariate problem, and the dialogues have reflected that complexity, and I hope to do it some justice in my talk today. It's also interesting for me to be doing this talk in Texas. I mean, for a lot of people, myself included, Texas looms large in my imagination, not just because I came here as a young man in a van, camping in Big Bend and various other places. I mean, once you've seen this landscape, it will always be in your imagination. That's the nature of this place. But as someone who really thinks about clean energy, obviously I think about Texas, and I think about oil, I think about fossil fuel infrastructure, then the scale of the fossil fuel infrastructure here. And as someone who stays up late at night, you know, I'm a carbon geek, worried about carbon counts, and I really do stay up late at night worrying about carbon counts. You know, I think about the drought that hit Texas last year, and I think about the predictions of prolonged drought in the American Southwest. And so you have oil and repercussions of oil coming together, you know, in Texas. And I think it's happening right now. And so it's very poignant. But I think more optimistically, what I've been exposed to in my brief time here, it's pretty clear to anybody who comes through this place that there's a very sort of pragmatic go-to kind of attitude here, right? And certainly not afraid of scale. So let's channel that kind of Texas attitude about scale and pragmatism as we think about the solutions that I'm going to talk about. Because the last thing that these solutions are is small, and the last thing that they are is not ambitious. So let's think about that as I talk about these sort of solutions. My argument is very simple, right? First, and we've talked a lot about this weekend, it is not optional that we decarbon our economy. We do not have a choice but to build a low-carbon economy. It will happen on our time and our schedule, or it will happen on nature's schedule, but it is going to happen. So number one, we got to do it. Number two, we can, right? Channeling Obama somehow there. I didn't mean to. It just happened. And this is the primary part of my argument, right? Contrary to a lot of energy analysts and pundits, it is entirely possible to run our economy, our industrial modern economy, on clean energy. As a matter of fact, I would argue clean energy is better capable of powering our economy. It is ready to step up to the main stage, and I think we need, I'm going to make the argument that it can. But three, contrary to lots of well-meaning NGOs, dear to my heart, but a little naive, it is not a matter of just getting the bad guys out of the way. This is the most difficult thing humankind has ever tried to do. The energy infrastructure that we are using is the most complex machine we've ever built, and we need to rebuild that infrastructure in less than a lifetime. And the kind of capital we need to move and the kind of political will we need to generate, we have never done before. And the kind of cooperation we need to generate internationally, we've never done before. So make no mistake, it's difficult. Necessary, possible, difficult. It's a very simple three-step argument. We've been talking about why this is necessary. I think we need to be honest about how great the fossil fuel party has been, right? I mean, I'm not going to throw arrows at fossil fuel. It's why I'm here. Fossil fuel is the single most important variable as to why we have the lives that we have, right? It wasn't just the thinking of the philosophers in the Renaissance that got us out of the muck. It was cheap energy, right? So let's be fair about that. It's been a really good party, but that party has to end, right? And the challenge we have is ending that party gracefully, right? Anybody who's had a big party knows there's two ways parties can end, right? So we need to end this party gracefully. And the main point I want to make is, look, clean energy has been treated in public debate, particularly in Canada and down in the States, like the kids' table at the dinner party, right? A lot of sound and fury and enthusiasm, but not a lot of substance. Some solar panels, it's kind of like a toy. It's a kid's thing. That view is mistaken. As a matter of fact, I will argue that clean energy is all grown up, kids are all grown up, and we are better capable of handling this party than the fossil fuel folks. Now, we need that infrastructure, we need that expertise, and we need that engineering and that capital, right? This is not going to be done without the energy giants. They need to be part of the solution. But clean energy is perfectly capable of stepping up to the plate, and that's the primary argument that I'm going to make. We are no longer the kids' table at the dinner party. I'm going to talk very briefly about this because I think unless we understand how difficult this is going to be, then we will shy away from the scale of solution that we need to build. David Buckland has made some great art that captures why this is so difficult. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our economic models and some of the assumptions baked into the way we do business that makes this really difficult. But for one thing, it's just really, really big. We need to build a lot of infrastructure. Very briefly, look, we've talked all weekend about why we need to do this, but I'm going to make two simple points, right? One, we've known about this for a long time. It is not a newcomer to the scene, climate change, right? We've known since the 1800s that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. None other than Margaret Thatcher, right? Anybody remembers Margaret Thatcher? The Iron Lady herself, back in 1989, put a lot of political and social capital at risk when she told the UN General Assembly that this is the single greatest threat facing our civilization. Now, she was a champion of the free market, a good friend of Ronald Reagan's, a military hawk, a union buster. The last thing the Iron Lady could be accused of being is a shill for the environmental movement, right? I mean, so this is not a left or right issue, is my point. We've known about it for a long time. It's become a left or right issue. There are reasons for that, and I'll talk about that. This is a practical problem to be solved that we've known about for a while, and it just seems like it's in a hurry now, that it's in some urgency now, because we've been ignoring it. And there are reasons we've been ignoring it, perfectly good reasons. We're rational to ignore it. It's a difficult truth to absorb. But the point I'm making is we have to go in a hurry, and it's not a left or right issue. It's a practical problem to be solved. Second, we don't need to argue about science anymore. As much fun as it is, and as much fun as I love hearing two scientists tell us about the nuances of their work, fast forward to 2011, the International Energy Agency, which is one of the most conservative groups on the planet, set up in response to the OPEC oil crisis to advise Western governments on energy security. I mean, this is as conservative as it gets, right? They have defended the fossil fuel industry for a long time. Climate change has been a footnote in their reports year after year after year because it is not in their interest to acknowledge it. This does not make them comfortable. 2011, they came out of the closet and they have acknowledged that we are in store, what was in store for us, 9 degrees Fahrenheit plus of warming by the end of this century. The point I'm making here is adults today do not have to argue or understand the science. They can if they want. It's great. We should all be enlightened. All we need to do as adults is make the following intuitive judgment, right? Who is more trustworthy? The International Energy Agency, NASA, and the National Academy of Science, or Mitt Romney and Fox News? I mean, it's sad if it wasn't so funny, right? I mean, that's the kind of judgment that we need to bring to bear now. So I'm saying we don't need to go into the nuances of the science. When the International Energy Agency says 9 degrees is coming, they have no interest in ringing a false alarm bell, right? So let's stop the argument. And we, as adults, need to figure out and make the easy judgment as to which groups of people are credible, right? It's not that hard to do. So on to solutions, which is the main part of my talk. There's two things that we need to do, right? The poor cousin of clean tech. I mean, clean tech is like, you know, really sexy business these days, right? Solar panels and geothermal and energy storage and grids and utilities. And so on. The poor cousin is efficiency, right? But there's two things we do. One is we need to produce more economic output, more t-shirts, more cars, more buildings, more books, more conferences, per unit of energy. It's very simple. Japan and Germany produce twice as much economic output as we do, Canadians and Americans, than they do. They are more economically competitive as a result, and they are hedged against increased energy costs. They have a more robust economy. So efficiency is not a hippie thing. Right? I mean, it can be, but I'm making the point that it is a fundamental indicator of the economic resilience of your economy, right? Efficiency indicates how competitive you are when oil hits 150, right? 160, 170 a barrel, which is going to come back. So first of all, we need to be efficient, right? And that's pretty simple. Now, the upside for North America, and I include Canada in this, we are as inefficient as the United States, we haven't yet made the investments in capital to lower our energy use, right? So, Japan and Germany have steel sectors, auto sectors, they have winters. I mean, it's not an issue of that. They've invested the capital in making their industries more efficient. I'll give you an example of this in a moment that I'm involved with. But efficiency is the first step. Second step, more energy per unit of carbon, right? And that's the clean energy portion. So more economic output per unit of energy, less carbon per unit of energy, right? And that's a two-step process. It's pretty simple. So I'm going to give you an example of why efficiency is so important. We will not solve this problem without the poor, uncool cousin of efficiency at the table. Biofuels is an example, right? So biofuels, essentially, instead of taking hydrocarbons that have been baked from an ancient carbon cycle, we are taking hydrocarbons from the current carbon cycle. The plants we put into our tanks have sucked out carbon out of the air, and it goes on and on, just like the food we eat, right? Biofuel. It's not literally pumping fuel from a farmer's field. That's a metaphor, but we can take biomass and make fuel out of it. Now, obviously, we can't do this out of food. I think that one of the silliest things we've done is the corn ethanol subsidy. There's not enough corn. We know that 40% of the corn crop goes to ethanol, and we produce, 5 to 7% in our gasoline? I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. If we took all the soybeans in North America and we converted every soybean to biodiesel, we would replace 5% of the diesel that we use. So there is no way first-generation biofuels are of any interest to me. They're certainly not a solution to this problem. And this point has been made. And no one works harder, by the way, on solving the biofuel problem than Richard Branson, right? Richard Branson famously flew a plane on 1/2 coconut oil to prove it could be done. Before the plane landed, literally, some bright spark of an analyst pointed out there's not enough coconuts in the world to feed half of Heathrow. So he made a point, right? And he's proving that these things can be done. But what we need are next-generation biofuels. Cellulosic ethanol, for example, you're turning wood chips into fuel. And there are a number of these companies coming out of the gate. There's a number of them in Canada, a number of them in the States. They've been slow out of the gate, but they are coming, and they are going to be reliable, and they will work. The problem is there is an upper limit on the amount of biomass in total that we can turn into this fuel. There's a great report put out by the U.S. Department of Energy called the Billion Ton Report. There's a theoretical upper limit of half of the oil being replaced by biomass-based liquid fuels, right? So we cannot use the amount of oil that we're using if we're going to get off fossil fuels. That's the hard truth, right? So the first thing to do is use less. So, you know, Obama's new standards on automobiles, that's the single most effective thing that's happened in North America to counter carbon and reduce reliance on oil that's happened in 25 years, right? At a stroke of a pen, he's regulated an industry that is being dragged kicking and screaming in the 21st century, and there you go. You're going to halve the amount of oil you use in transport with that directive. Europe gets 2 to 3 times as much mileage per in their vehicles than the United States does. So this is really low-hanging fruit, right? And, you know, why we think we need to have engines that get, you know, 10 miles per gallon, I don't know. You can build pretty fast cars to go, they're a lot more efficient. So that's clear. We have to use less oil. That's efficiency. You cannot replace oil with the amount of cellulosic ethanol, right? So one of the questions I ask in my book to test these kind of limits on different technologies is I call the trillion-dollar question. What do you get for $1 trillion? And I ask that question for 3 reasons. One, you find limits to some of these technologies. Some of these technologies will simply not scale up. So we shouldn't view that pathway as being one of the ones that we want to pay attention to. And then two, we find out how cheap energy can get. I'll give some examples in a moment. Because when cheap comes with scale, right? Cost comes down as you make more of something. Solar's come down 75% in price in the last 2 years because of scale. So three, by asking that question, I'm doing an apples-to-apples comparison. It is absolutely unfair to ask clean energy, whether it's solar or geothermal or biofuels, to perform in reliability and cost in the same way that fossil fuels does when fossil fuels have had tens of trillions of dollars of investment. One of our pundits up in Canada, Margaret Wente, just throws darts at every good idea. That's her job. Really annoying. You know, was making fun of Germany. Said, oh, Germany has spent $3.5 billion on solar and all they get is 4% of their energy from it. Well, what would you get from the tar sands if you spent $3.5 billion? A dribble. You would get almost nothing from the tar sands if you spent a mere $3.5 billion. So we need to be fair and compare apples to apples and start asking questions of different technologies. What do you get if we spent $1 trillion? Now, when I say spend $1 trillion, I'm not talking about governments writing checks. They'll be very clear about the kinds of policies that I think will work. And we do need policy. As David Buckland pointed out the other day, we need laws to get this done. And I'll talk about the difficulty of that conversation in a moment, right? Why that's a barrier. But we do need laws. I mean, a price on carbon, for one thing. So we're not going to be able to compare clean energy fairly to fossil fuels until we ask these kinds of questions. And I'm talking about private capital flowing, right? I'm not talking about public capital. I'm not talking about the government writing checks. The government's role is to set the market rules so private sector capital flows into this sector. But we have to ask the trillion-dollar question, or simply not comparing apples to apples. So efficiency is important. This is the Tesla. Classic American car, right? It's not a golf cart, right? You can't touch the dashboard when they hit the accelerator. It's like, you know, this is an American car, right? It's a beautiful car. But the problem with electric cars is, of course, batteries are not a primary source of power. You need to charge them up. So some people think the magic bullet is electric car. It's not. I mean, if you converted every car in North America to electrical drivetrain, you would need to roughly double electrical production in this country. It is going to be hard enough turning off the 50% of your power that's made by coal, as it is. If you double the amount of electricity you produce, it makes the job that much harder. So electric cars are not an answer. So the other very unsexy cousin of clean tech is, you know, the bicycle and transit. Because that's how in big cities, which is where most people live, right, is that this is how you solve that problem. And if you spent $1 trillion, you'd get a whole lot of track and a whole lot of train. Right? So we need to be honest about that, too. Transportation in large cities cannot be based on the car. It's not going to work. So here's another example of efficiency that is really, really easy. This is a hotel that I built in Toronto. I'm the developer. And I took an abandoned building, made it into a hotel. It's built to the standards of a boutique hotel. And I asked the question, can we possibly lower the carbon in this hotel by 75% at a profit, right? 75% is not an arbitrary number. This is roughly what we need to cut our emissions globally by, 2030 or so. So it's not arbitrary, but I didn't have any idea if we could do it. I mean, this is sort of a, you know, throwing an arrow and seeing where it will land. Turns out it's easy, which is actually really disturbing. It's really easy to do. And we did it at a profit, right? No subsidies, nothing. So it's simple. We have geothermal heating and cooling, right? So instead of making heat, we suck heat out of the ground. And instead of making cold, we shove heat into the ground, right? I mean, there's only one cycle down here, so geothermal has different economics. but it works in the vast majority of the United States. This is half of our energy savings, roughly, geothermal heating and cooling. And we put it in a tiny laneway that runs beside the building, essentially in a dense downtown urban core. So the city owns that laneway, and the city has now opened up, City of Toronto has opened up laneways and parks throughout the city for geothermal as a result of this project. So we kind of made a point about dense downtown cores. There is now a company called Phoenix Energy. They've invented a drill rig that can drive into the bottom, the parking garage of any of these condo towers or corporate towers in our downtown cores, Chicago, New York, LA, doesn't matter where, operates in 7'2" headroom and can drill down a mile in a closed loop system running on electricity. So you can retrofit 70-story towers with geothermal now, right? So any building can do this. We grab some heat before it goes out of the drain. There's 114 showers a day there. So we grab that heat before it leaves. Very simple technology, just a copper pipe that's a heat exchanger. Grabs about 2/3 of that heat before it leaves. We have solar thermal to preheat our hot water on the roof, which works in the middle of winter in Toronto. We have minus 30 there, still works. And we have some very small amount of solar PV. You add all that up, some LED lighting, good insulation, nice windows, all that kind of stuff. Ain't rocket science, right? I actually thought it was going to be, the thing that was disturbing is how easy it was. So you add all that up, it's a 3/4 cut, and I'm more profitable for having done it. So here's the trick. Unlocking 5% of the building's capital, and this scales up from my building right up to the big towers as a rule of thumb. You take 1/20th of that building's value, you put that into energy retrofits, you will lower your carbon use by 3/4, and you will be cash flow positive from day one. Right? For every dollar I'm spending in loan payments to cover this retrofit, I'm saving $2 in my energy costs. And once I pay that loan back, it's absolutely free. Right? So the frustrating thing for me was how easy it was. So we have a prime minister who ripped up Kyoto, and he claimed that Kyoto would impoverish our country. Now, everything in that building, the heat exchanger, the heat pumps, the engineers, the pipes, the wires, the drillers, the drill rigs, the engineers, the trades, that's all Canadian labor. That's all Canadian technology. I am wealthier for having done it, not poorer. Every building in every major city in this continent could do what we did. The Empire State was recently rebuilt or had a retrofit. They saved 38% of their energy and they used 1.8% of their building's value. Same rule of thumb works. So when our Prime Minister, Harper, declared that Kyoto would impoverish us, right, we'd climb this giant hill, it'd be hard to do, we'd come out the other side with our pockets picked, absolute horse poop. We could have blown past Kyoto, just retrofitting our buildings, and everybody that did it would be richer, not poorer, and think of the economic stimulus that would have been. For our trades, for our plumbers, for our electricians, for the people that supplied that equipment to me, which is about 80% Canadian, you have the same technologies here, you have the same trades here, right? So it's an ideological decision on his part not to look at this. He's got people around him who are smart enough to see what I've seen. This isn't rocket science, right? I just happen to be motivated because I'm a carbon geek to get this done. Anyway, so we can blow past Kyoto easily and be wealthier for it. That's the point of energy retrofits in a building. We couldn't spend $1 trillion in energy efficiency in the G7. Why? Because the payback is so fast, we'd get it back faster than we spent it. We could only spend about $500 billion in energy efficiency. And we would lower our energy use by 25-30%. And we'd be wealthier for it. So that's efficiency, right? This is not going to get done without efficiency. The problem with efficiency is, if you're not an energy geek like me, you're not really motivated to do it. So I'm wealthier as a hotelier, but not by that much. It's not like it changes my life. It's a 5-year payback. Most people who have buildings want a 2-year payback or a 1-year payback. They want the retrofits to come out of their operating budget, not their capital budget. Capital budgets require different kinds of decisions, I guess. But all we need to get that done is a change in attitude in the CFOs of those companies. All they need to do is see energy as a line item on their income statement, see that as core to their business, right? That's something that's core to my business, whether I'm making chocolate bars or operating an office tower, suddenly I'm willing to use my capital budget and take a 3, 4, or 5-year payback. And if they did, they'd all be wealthier. The reason we're not doing that, because most of them aren't worried about carbon the way I am, we're not doing that because energy doesn't cost enough. Right? I am wealthier as a hotelier, but not that much. So the hard conversation that we cannot have, imagine running for office and saying, I'm going to raise the price of energy. That's a really hard argument to make. That's why we can't beat around the bush when it comes to saying, we have to do this. Right? And we can couch it in lots of different ways. Retooling America, green jobs, all kinds of other things, right? That's why we talk about retrofitting buildings and the benefits to the trades and the welders and so on. Lots of people benefit from that work. But to really unlock that, we have to pay more for energy. And that's an adult conversation that requires climate change to be part of the mix, right? And that's a tough one. Anyway, so this is the cooler part, right? This is where you build a clean energy, what we call a clean energy internet. Again, there's only so much biofuel, so we're going to electrify everything. And greening the grid is easy. This is a no-brainer. I'll take you through it. The first is solar. Solar comes from the sun. Now, if you had a map of Texas for the benefit of the people on the radio that was the size of your palm, that's the size of Texas on a map, if you put a solar farm in Texas the size of your thumbnail, right? Real existing current technology, not future technology, today's technology. This is an engineering diagram, so it takes into account the solar panels have to be so many feet apart and it's only 15% efficient. This is an engineering diagram. You would produce all of the primary energy used by the United States. Obviously, you have to distribute it. Obviously, you have to have it available on demand. But the point being, in Canada, they sort of say, real men melt tar for energy, and that's how you keep the factories going. Right? And here they say, we blow tops off mountains and dig out the coal. That's how we keep our industrial infrastructure going. Solar's a toy. Absolute nonsense. There is more energy available from solar than we will ever get out of those mountains, and than we will ever get out of melting that tar. We just have to build a big enough plant. We just need to ask the question, what do you get for $1 trillion? And shape the market so the $1 trillion flows into that sector. And when the $1 trillion flows into that sector, solar beats nat gas on price. Hands down. Hands down. Right? So it is a myth that we cannot run our industrial civilization on clean energy because there's not enough energy. Now, we need to make the energy available and so on. I'll talk about that in a second. But that I can make that same argument about geothermal. I can almost make the argument about wind, right? There's more than enough out there. This is not toy stuff. You just have to build really big plants. Plants in Spain are 20 megawatts. These are old plants built 20 years ago. The key that they proved on these plants was you can store the energy. These plants run on heat. They're not photovoltaic. Giant mirrors reflect the light and use molten salt as a working fluid. That's how hot it gets. And if you want to store some of that energy to use when the sun goes down, you put in a giant thermos. And when the sun goes down, you pop the thermos and you use the heat. It is dispatchable energy. Very cheap storage. Cheapest form of energy storage we have, because you're just storing a bunch of liquid that's hot and it's not hard to do, right? It's dispatch. And these things are the size of coal plants. They are now being built at the gigawatt scale, which is the size of a very large coal plant or a very large nuclear plant. Dispatchable power. A solar plant with storage is more useful than a nuke plant because it is variable, right? Nuke plant's just flat. And it competes with nat gas on price when you scale it up, right? And I'm comparing this to the tar sands because that's kind of our target in Canada. You gotta compete with the tar sands. So the energy cost per BTU is far less than what you get from melting tar, far less. So wind, opponents of wind, there are a number of different opponents of wind. Some people don't like the way they look, and I can't argue with that. I like them, they don't, I don't know. Lots of things I don't like, I have to put up with. But I think the thing about wind, that the criticism that does strike heart to heart, the wind doesn't always blow, right? So if you see a wind farm and the wind is not blowing, you sort of think, well, that's not the way to run a civilization, right? That's not a reliable source of power. And on individual wind farms, that's an absolutely valid criticism. The only way wind will work and the only way it will become useful in North America is if it's distributed across different weather systems, right? It's not true the wind isn't always blowing. It's just not always blowing in the same place, right? The wind is always blowing. Right? So what you need to do is commit to a scale on wind where you have wind farms in Ontario and Quebec, onshore, offshore, the prairies, Texas, Mexico, hooked together. If you're not going to commit to that scale of wind, I admit it's not that useful. It's okay. I mean, I'm not going to poo-poo it, but it's not really going to step up to the plate. So again, we need to think about scale the way we have with fossil fuel infrastructure. That kind of capital, that kind of scale, and clean energy steps up to the plate. So you'd replace 20% of U.S. production with $1 trillion. I would point out, too, and I keep throwing around this number of $1 trillion, Stiglitz made the point, what did Iraq cost? $3 to $4 trillion? What did the bank bailout cost? Well, we don't know, because it's not transparent, but it's somewhere between $2 and $6 trillion of immediately available capital. We throw trillions around all the time. And by the way, pension funds are sitting on $100 trillion of assets right now. We know where the capital is to solve this problem. We just need to send the market signal to have that capital flow into this sector. And this can happen. There's no reason this can't happen. So geothermal, geothermal for heating and cooling buildings is one thing. This is the deep stuff, right? The really hot stuff, like lava kind of stuff. It's okay. I mean, you know, there's only limited places where you can get it. But the holy grail of clean energy is called enhanced geothermal. So you know you're drilling for fracking for natural gas not too far from here? Drill deeper, frack, and get heat. The rock about 8 kilometers down is somewhere like 300, 350 degrees Celsius. Fahrenheit, that's, I don't know, 500 degrees or something like that. It's hot. You fracture the rock, you drill one hole, drill another hole, shove some liquid down, fracture the rock. You're way beneath the water table, right? This is 350 degree rock. You extract the heat, make electricity. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Baseload power. This is actually extremely cheap. There are working plants in Australia. They are drilling holes like crazy. They've got a working plant in Germany. Now, there's scale-up issues. I mean, this one isn't out of the box, but you know, this guy, the Google guys have invented in a company called Potter Drilling, lowers the cost of drilling by half using superheated steam. The point I'm making about enhanced geothermal is this. Canada is committing $3 billion, government money, not private, but government money, feds and province, for carbon sequestration. It's a good idea? I don't think so, but all hands on deck. You give it a shot. There's an enormous amount of subsidies for nuclear out there. I'm ambivalent on nuclear. The ones that are going, I think you should keep them going. But it's a good argument to me. Nuclear's expensive, you know, and you can't insure them. An enormous amount of capital has been dedicated to these projects. There's not much being dedicated to enhanced geothermal, but enhanced geothermal has a better capacity of replacing existing coal, in my mind, than carbon sequestration ever will. You want to replace a coal plant? Drill two holes, fracture the rock, take the furnace, throw it out, put in a heat exchanger, keep everything else the same, you've replaced the coal plant. All you have to do is make the cost of the capital for doing that less than or equal to the input cost of coal and the risk on a carbon price. So get rid of the carbon price, just make it less than equal to the cost of coal, you're done. Every coal plant owner on the planet would have an economic incentive to do that. Are we trying it? No, not very hard. I don't know why. This is an extremely promising technology, right? So that's geothermal. Yeah, and by the way, it is cheap. Some numbers have come out of Department of Energy, and you scale it up, and the footnotes are in my book. You'd replace the entire North American coal infrastructure, everything with enhanced geothermal. Right? Now you're going to run into trouble with coal miners, right? They're going to be out of a job. So there's all kinds of complex issues in implementing this. The point I'm making is we don't need fossil fuels to run our economy. It is perfectly possible to do it with clean energy. The workhorse of clean energy today is hydro. Hydro is responsible for like 99%, give or take a percent or two, of our clean energy today. I mean, it's just a huge workhorse because it's been around for a long time, right? The problem is we've developed most of the good sites. It's responsible globally for 20%, I think, of our power. The problem is, of course, that we've used the good sites. We might be able to double hydro production by 2050, but by then energy use will have doubled, so it'll stay at about 20%. This is near where I live in Niagara Falls. It's not without controversy, right? Three Gorges Dam in China buried a lot of stuff, right? I mean, it's not without costs. Nothing's free. Right? So it's a matter of weighing your risk. To be fair, the Three Gorges Dam displaces enough fossil fuel that it is equivalent to taking double the cars off the Canadian roads. So we're a tenth of your size. So I'm going to guess it's going to be about a fifth of your cars. Take them off the road. That's that one dam. So if we're going to expect China to step up to the plate, we have to accept that there are going to be mega projects like this. They're not without controversy, though, I would say. In Niagara Falls, the world's biggest drill bit is adding more capacity to, she's called Big Becky, and she's putting more power into our hydro in Ontario, which we use, by the way, or we're talking about using, as a peaking plant. So as we install more wind in Ontario, we have Niagara Falls hydro to match the wind variability. So before we have this North American network, which I dream of, you do have the ability to play one clean source against another, right? And when they build Lower Churchill up in Newfoundland and feed that power down to Maine, you can do the same thing, right? You can have an enormous amount of wind on that grid and just have hydro act as the varier, as a variable. You have to put in the economic incentives because the different plants are owned by different people, so there are regulatory issues and so on, but it's perfectly feasible. You'd replace about 2/3 of U.S. coal power. But again, there's upper limits on how much we can make of this stuff because we've taken the good sites. A lot of people like ocean energy. I'm not so much a fan of ocean energy. I think wave energy is not really worth pursuing. I may be wrong. There's just not enough of it out there. And it's very, very difficult to build. There are as many ways to get wave energy as there are inventors trying to do it. There's a group called the Plamis is a giant worm-like creature off the coast of Portugal. These are harsh conditions. Engineers are very capable of dealing harsh conditions, so I think you could make it work, but the prize isn't big enough. So even Britain, an island nation, could maybe get 4% of their power from wave. So I just don't think it's a path that we wanna pursue, but so be it. What is more interesting is tidal. Tidal is very regular and very cheap. In the Bay of Fundy in Canada, we all know, I don't know if you visited the Bay of Fundy, fastest moving tidal channel in the world, you can get 7 gigawatts, so that's 7 massive nuclear reactors equivalents, massive coal plants, out of the Bay of Fundy, only moving the tide, the line where the tide, the high point and low point of the tide, because you affect the tides and you suck power out of it. I mean, nothing's free, by 2%. So limiting that change to 2%, you can get 7 gigawatts out of the Bay of Fundy. So locally, it can be extremely powerful, but globally, the most you'll ever get, I think, out of tidal power is roughly equivalent to U.S. energy production today. But it's cheap. For $1 trillion, you would get the equivalent globally of the entire U.S. electrical production. This is one of the cheapest kinds of power around. Very regular, right? We know when it comes, so utilities like it. They can plan for it, that kind of thing. So what happens? So when I'm telling the story of individual technologies, and I'm making the case that we need to think about this stuff on the kind of scale that we do with fossil fuels, trillions of dollars. I'll nuance where we get the trillion for in a second. But clean energy becomes reliable, efficient, and cheap when you do it that way. You basically have a continent-wide grid where you're playing off one kind of power against another, right? So the sun sets on the west, the tide starts to turn on the east, the sun dies in the prairies, it picks up in the north. So you're basically balancing one kind of energy against another and one geography against another, right? That's how you make clean energy reliable. And if you're not going to commit to that scale of infrastructure, don't bother, right? The critics are right. Our factories won't keep humming because it is intermittent power. We have some storage coming down the pipeline and so on too. But unless you're going to commit to some giant grid of high voltage DC lines tying this stuff together, you're not going to make clean energy compete with fossil fuels. But again, I say apples to apples. If you are going to ask clean energy to step up to the plate, you have to give it a fair shake. And that means you need to think about this kind of energy, this scale of energy infrastructure. Right, so the intelligence then comes in. You have a continent-wide grid balancing one kind against another. You also have a regional grid where you're essentially, you can balance load to supply. All the wires become two-way. You have lots of micro-production, so little smaller solar farms and smaller wind farms hook up to the grid. So it's no longer, coal plant plus spokes going out, right? You have a much more intelligent grid regionally. And then at the local level, you balance supply and demand at the top, right? And that's just some good networking. That's just good computers and some wires and some signals, which in Canada, we had a company called Nortel. We were great at that. Lots of companies in the States know how to do that. That's the smarts of the smart grid, right? And then you put in some storage, and there are interesting storage capabilities coming down the pipeline, underwater compressed air, ultra-low friction flywheels. So these are coming, and they sort of add that last little bit to make all that intelligence and all that stability smooth out. So that's what you build. That's the energy internet. I stole that term from Thomas Friedman. But that's what we're building, or trying to build. And if we're not going to commit to that, you know what? The critics are right. Clean energy will not step up to the plate. But this is how you rebuild an energy infrastructure. So how do you get there? We need policy. This is the hard part. As David Buckland pointed out, we need laws, right? And in my mind, there is one simple law that will get us there. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But why are we doing this, right? Let's ask the question why we're doing this. It was Pascal, French mathematician, who first asked the question. What is the risk, what is the value, what is the risk of a low probability but catastrophic event? Asteroid hitting the Earth or something, right? 1% chance, wipeout. Well, the risk is high because it's catastrophic, right? I mean, essentially, it's a math game of zero times infinity. Depends how you define zero, depends how you define infinity. But the point he's making is very clear. If you are dealing with a catastrophic event, you have to take it seriously. The risk is high. The problem we have is that catastrophic climate change is not marginally possible. It is looking more and more likely, right? So we have a medium probability of a catastrophic event. Well, what do? You mitigate it. You lower the probabilities, right? That's your response. So that's the first layer of analysis on policy. That's what you're doing. You're trying to lower the risk of this catastrophic event. And it's easy to define what those risks are. Nick Stern did a lot of work in trying to define how we work it out financially. And I'll talk about his critics in a moment. The second thing we're doing, we're creating global. This is the largest market in the 21st century, right? Jurisdictions that get this right will be selling stuff to the rest of the world, and jurisdictions that don't will be buying it. There's a reason why Silicon Valley still generates value, right? They were first to the market with the microchip and software, and they've maintained the global lead all this time. Paul Krugman's thesis was how regional disparities in a flat world remain. Once you get a head start, you keep a head start. And, you know, Silicon Valley didn't come from nowhere, right? The internet wasn't invented in a garage. It was military demand for the microchip and so on, right? There was strategic importance placed on that industry. So jurisdictions that figure this out are playing in the single global market of the 21st century. You've got to sort of have the Joe regular be a part of this, right? That's why I talk a lot about retrofitting buildings, because you're talking about trades and plumbers and electricians and engineers, right? This is retooling America, and then you retool the world. I don't know, brand it however you got to brand it. I'm not a marketing guy, but that's part of what we're trying to figure out here, right? How is it that we communicate the opportunities that come out of this policy so that it's not a right or left issue? It is an economic development issue. It's a smart thing to do, right? That's what we're trying to communicate. And the last thing, of course, we're doing is ensuring long-term growth. There is no such thing as high-carbon economic growth anymore. There may be for a year or two, but as we're seeing with drought, as we're seeing with increased extreme weather, this will eat itself. If we continue to think we're going to build an economy on a carbon backbone, it will collapse. There is no such thing as long-term high-carbon growth, right? So for those who like growth, and this is sort of baked into our economics, the only way you're going to even approach that, never mind the philosophical question of isn't infinite growth possible, just push that aside, just for the next decade or two, you have to switch to a low-carbon economy. There's no such thing as a high-carbon growth. We know what policy would do it, and I'm going to, in my mind, you price carbon at the source, distribute all that money that you collect to the population, so it's revenue neutral. And in a market economy, you have changed every single market transaction overnight. Every consumer transaction, every project finance transaction changes because there's a price on carbon. But you have to have a conversation about a price on carbon. This will not happen by itself, right? So that's part of what... And look, when Mitt Romney makes fun of Obama for making climate change a national security issue, that is one of the most harmful pieces of public dialogue I have ever heard. I think that's shameful, not just because it stops us from having a conversation about rebuilding our economy in a way that's sustainable, which I think smart people would like to do, right? But he's using a soapbox and talking about an extremely dangerous event. In the middle of the biggest drought in living memory in the United States, he's making fun of the president for taking it seriously. I think that's shameful that our public leaders get away with that stuff. He's not being called to account, and I don't know why. So why aren't we doing this, right? We know that we have to. We know where the technologies are. We know where the capital sits. And we know what policy will get us there. Why aren't we doing it? We've all heard, and this is my current work, this is my next book. We've all heard the story, every school kid's heard it, but the frog and the pot of water and the stove, right? It's a horrible story. You put a frog in a pot of water, you put the pot of water on the stove, you turn the stove on, the frog won't jump out of the water. It's a true story, because the water heats slowly enough that his poor physiology can't detect it, but fast enough that it traps him and he boils to death. Are we that frog? It looks a lot like we might be. Now, in asking that question, I'm not throwing darts. I'm saying there are reasons why we are acting like that frog. I'm going to talk about them in a second. And I've painted a picture of a house on a hill, right? clean energy infrastructure, move trillions of dollars policy, yada, 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 yada. That's just a fantasy unless we understand the structural reasons why we're not moving there. Right? So I'm not talking about just bad guys, right? I think there are structural reasons why we're not doing this. And if we can figure out what the structural reasons are, then we can undo them and we can move there. So I think any reasonable solution has to acknowledge the problem. The problem isn't climate change, the problem is structural. For example, in our economic models, I debated Bjorn Lomborg. Anybody know Bjorn Lomborg? I debated him a couple summers back. And I thought, in preparation for the debate, I thought, well, he's so far apart from me, right? He's getting all his data from the IPCC, and he claims to use all the latest economic models, and he says, don't worry, wait, be happy. And I look at the same data, and I say, oh my God, you know, starting gun has gone off, let's go. How can we be so different? So like a good philosopher, I went to the source of his data. It is a model out of Yale called Dice and Rice, Dynamic Integrated Model of the Climate and the Economy, built by a guy called Nordhaus. This model is used by almost all policymakers when they look at the cost benefits of a climate policy. Lomborg leans on it extensively. So I looked at it. They've taken complex science, which we heard a little bit about yesterday, dumbed it down to four simple linear equations so it'll work in their spreadsheets. Nordhaus admits this. He's an honest academic. He says, I don't take into account the possibility of catastrophic climate change. One. I don't take into account nonlinearities in the climate system. Two. I was pointing this out to Lee Smolin, a physicist at the Perimeter Institute. He said, what's the point of building complex climate models if you just plug them into a dumb economic model? And he's right. The most amazing thing about this model, though, aside from ruling out of court all the stuff that we're worried about, nonlinearities, tipping points, catastrophic climate change, it's like no wonder Lomborg's not worried about it. It's not even his model. But just because something's not in a model doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Nobody modeled house prices falling everywhere in the United States all at once. That's what happens when you build up systemic risk and ignore it, and the model breaks. Oh, too bad. Well, Treasury was there to fix that, but Treasury ain't going to be there to fix this. Right? So we can't get this one wrong. So the models by which we're evaluating options on climate policy are so flawed, it's not even in the footnotes, it's in the front page of this model. You don't have to go very far to find it. Now, the most amazing thing about this model, too, though, is something called the discount rate. Discount rate basically puts tomorrow's dollars in today's dollars, right? So it's like interest rate. So $100 10 years from now is worth less than $100 now. The discount rate is it's like a ringer in a basketball game. Because if you go out 50 years, you have a discount rate of 5 or 6%. It doesn't matter what happens in 50 or 60 years. You basically, it's an exponential curve, right? It squashes it down to nothing. And the discount rates in these models are 5, 6%. So anything happening in 2050 or 2100 has no economic bearing on our decisions today, right? It's like going to a neighborhood basketball game and bringing a ringer from the NBA. That one variable swamps everything else. Anyway, there's more to say about the discount rate and why I think it's not an empirical measurement of economic activity, but a value judgment about future generations. So I think there's lots of debate around that. But the point I'm making is our economic models have baked into it inaction. That's one reason why the frog ain't moving. So let's change the economic model. The myth of the free market, right? People somehow view the market as like a shrub or a tree or a tiger, like it's something we discovered. Right, and we subsume ourselves under its laws. Right, anything we do to play with it brings inefficiencies into it because it's a thing. It's a natural kind. The market is an artifact. It is something we built. We made banks, CDOs, checks, laws, contract law, IPOs, stock, bonds, interest. We invented all that stuff. Right? It's like an iPod, not a tiger. And the challenge for us is to re-engineer that thing so it solves this problem, right? And if you actually look at the math behind the assumptions of the free market and why it needs to be left alone, Adam Smith, right up through the Chicago School, this is math from the 17th century, 18th century, when economics was trying to become a real science. And the notion that there's an equilibrium that the free market finds that is optimal for everybody is an artifact of simplifying the math enough so you get a solution. Well, guess what? The economy is complicated, right? You need 21st century math to talk about it. Complex dynamic systems, evolutionary economics. This is a much more useful language to describe the economic system. So the free market is a kind of an ideological myth that has this academic history that people take seriously, but it's nonsense. There's no such thing as a free market. A free market you might find in the hills outside of Afghanistan, where, you know, all you do is have tough guys make the rules, right? There's no such thing as a free market. We don't let tough guys sell white powder to kids. Why? It's immoral. So we already make value judgments and embed them into our laws. So our challenge is very simple. How do we engineer economic models to drive our economy in the direction of a low-carbon economy? And it's easy. You put a price on carbon. I mean, there's no simpler thing to do, right? Because what you can't do, and what I agree with, you can't pick technologies. Maybe these are the winners, maybe they're not. I think they're promising, the ones that I pointed out. But you want the market to figure it out. The market is a highly complicated thing that only ever works with millions of interactions happening all the time. So the most you'll ever do is set the rules of the game. You'll never define the outcome. You'll never predict where it's going to go. Technology changes too quickly. People are too full of their foibles. You cannot impose a solution, right? This is where the left has it wrong. You can't pick a winner and say, go there. What you can do, set the rules of the game and let the thing roll, right? So you can set it in a particular direction, and that's what we need to do. So there's a free market mythology that dominates North American discussions that I think is just, it's backward. And there's a deep conservatism to most corporate cultures. There are exceptions, Duke Energy, Florida Power and Light. There are some enlightened people out there. But typically, look, if you made a bunch of money yesterday, and you're gonna make a bunch of money today, looks like you're gonna make a bunch of money tomorrow, why would you change your behavior, right? And if you're a middle management, you're making $250,000 a year, why would you buck the trend? You're making $250,000, deal with it later. There is a deeply conservative kind of psychology in our professional classes. Now, to be fair, they have been trained to keep the ship going in a direction, and they're very good at that. Again, the fossil fuel party has been a great party, right? Utilities are complicated things. People are very good at keeping them running. What they're not good at is turning that ship, right? That's the challenge. And of course, it's bankers ultimately that decide what we install. We entrepreneurs don't decide, because if you're going to install anything at scale, it's debt capital that you need to find to build it. And who gives you debt capital? Bankers. Now, I know when I say bankers are conservative, it's going to strike an odd tone, right? They take their own kinds of risks if they have the rules working that way. But when it comes to infrastructure, hardware, extremely conservative. A banker will need to see a technology in operation for 15 to 20 years before they will provide debt at low cost. So a natural gas plant or a coal plant gets debt at 2 or 3%. A solar plant in the market, 12 to 13%. 40% of the cost of solar on the big plants is the cost of debt, right? So there's baked into our sort of financial models a deep conservatism, but how slowly we'll ever turn that ship. And that's okay if we didn't have to turn the ship. Right? It's not I don't even have a value judgment. I'm just making an empirical point. But we do have to turn the ship, right? So there's a kind of a deep conservatism built around big finance, built around our professional management classes. And if you go to an MBA school, there are very few that talk about carbon, climate change, sustainability in any real way, right? There are exceptions. But in most MBA schools, sustainability is essentially corporate and social responsibility, which is a small budget to tell the public you're doing good things, right? So the next generation is not being taught to turn the ship either. So that's another thing that keeps the frog from moving, baked into our economy, right? So we need to acknowledge that. And then the last thing, and I'm going to sort of end on this one, because I think this is where I think Cape Farewell really comes into its own. It's really hard to believe that climate change is as bad as it is. It is bleak. And there's a reason for that, right? There's sort of two ways to look at this. One, a lot of my academic work looked at the mind. I'm a recovered academic. But it looked at the mind as a neural network and asked the question, how do we form beliefs? How is it that we decide something is true? Whether identifying something as a, you know, that's a bush or that's a tree, or that's a graceful act, that person is mean. How is it that we make a judgment about something being true? And ultimately, what a neural network does from the day we're born is form connections between things. Very simple. Roar is associated with tiger, is associated with claw, is associated with animal. Ballerina is associated with graceful. And you go through your life and you literally hardwired into your brain, right, are associations between ideas. And over time, that becomes a worldview. It becomes kind of the common sense we bring to bear to make sense of a situation. Because that's what we've evolved to do, make sense of complex, arbitrary situations, right? But there's a cost to that. The cost to that is when new data comes in, it goes through that engine, that worldview, and it's filtered. And if your worldview happens to include the economy always gets bigger, tomorrow's always better than today, free market solves all problems, couldn't possibly affect the earth, it's too big. I mean, these are really deeply held ideas by all of us because it's part of our culture. Climate change bumps up against every one of those ideas. So when climate change comes knocking at your mind's door, it gets shut out. Another way to put this is Daniel Kahneman in his book, Fast and Slow Thinking. He calls them cognitive biases and cognitive shortcuts. So one thing that happens if someone asks you, do you believe in climate change? It's actually a really hard thing to understand or even answer because there is science and there's trust, all kinds of issues. You'll actually answer an easier question. You'll answer a question like, how does climate change make you feel? That's the question your unconscious will actually answer. Of course, it makes you scared. And emotions play a central role in how we interpret this data and form connections between events, right? Negative emotions are hugely powerful on how data is interpreted, how it's incorporated into your worldview. Kahneman points out a bunch of others, right? There's peer group bias, so we trust our friends more than we trust experts. There's confirmation bias, so we look for stuff. We heard about this yesterday from Michael Pollan, that we look for stuff that corroborates things we already believe. I read the paper, and I find an article that makes the case climate change might not be. I gobble that thing up like a Hoover, because I don't want climate change to be real. This is a hard belief to have. It is a siren song, denial. And denial is not just saying it's not true. Denial could be ignoring it. We all ignore it. We have to. Otherwise, you go crazy. So denial is not simply saying, I don't believe it. Denial can be, I'm not going to pay attention to it right now. Right? Someone in denial of the alcoholism kind of ignores the problem. Right? And this is part of what's in the way of us solving this problem. There are a whole lot of cognitive biases. It is very difficult to make the case to anybody about climate change, particularly for the right. This is why it's politicized. Because one of the worldviews of the right, there's two that are relevant. Historically, the conservatives in any country, steady hand at the tiller, right? You make big, abrupt changes to your social structures at your peril. And that is really good advice a lot of the time, right? That is a valid position, steady hand at the tiller. The problem is there's now a paradox. Business as usual will not preserve the status quo. Business as usual will take us off a cliff. So radical change is coming unless we make radical change. That's a deep paradox for conservatives to grapple with. Now, one way out might be to say market solutions, right? So your champion is the market. The market can solve this problem, yada, yada, yada. Maybe they can ride into town on the market horse and be happy. I don't know. But it's a problem they're going to have. David Frum has written about this, said we have to figure out our position on climate change because we're looking sillier and sillier as time goes by as we deny it. So that fundamental paradox is there because there is a worldview held by conservatives that is now cast into doubt, unfortunately, right? Steady hand of the tiller will not do it anymore. The other is loving lack of state intervention. That's a deeply held belief by a lot of people. The only institution that is going to set the rules of the market to solve this problem is the state. We need laws. And if you don't believe in state intervention in your life, when climate change comes knocking at your door, you're going to find a reason not to believe it. And there are lots of reasons to find. The internet is full of this stuff. Volcano's going to go up. It's sun flares. Who knows, right? You'll find something. Because that's a worldview that is now called into question, right? So what I like about Cape Farewell and the notion that artists and scientists are getting together to figure this out, someone asked the question the other day, what's the great image that's going to solve the problem of climate change? I think it was Adrian that kind of said, well, I don't know if it's going to be one image. You're asking an awful lot of artists. But maybe embedded into all of our stories, there's going to be something about this truth. And artists are really good at I'm very direct. I don't know that anything I say about how scary climate change is affects anybody but those who are already worried about it. But artists are good at going around the back, right? Saying things obliquely, saying things indirectly, making comparisons, right? And embedding that kind of story, embedding that kind of dialogue in our art, in our culture, all over the place is really important. And I think Adrienne's right when she says it has to be in all the stories. Because if you're going to rewire the brain, which is what we're really trying to do, it is repetition in different contexts that matters. Repetition in different contexts that matters. That's the way we undo those worldviews to allow in belief in climate change. Now, there'll always be some people that will never believe it. So, you got to abandon ship at some point. But you're going for the middle, right? We're going for the middle. We have to find ways of telling these stories that get around these defenses. And these defenses are very powerful, right? They work in us, right? And I presume we're all here because we care, right? They work in us. If they work in us, you better believe it works outside this room. So I'm going to leave on the following note. I'm going to get much more practical now. One of the criticisms of action on climate change has consistently been it's going to cost too much. When Nick Stern came out with his report in 2006, I think it was, he sort of laid out a path and said, we got to spend, you know, a whole bunch of money on this, 1 to 2% of our GDP. In absolute terms, it's a big number, I don't know, $500 billion or something like that. And he couches it as kind of insurance, right? We got to buy some insurance to lower the risk of this whole thing blowing up. And his critics immediately came out and attacked him and said, look how expensive this is going to be, $500 billion a year of government subsidies. You're distorting the market. Sounds like a lot, $500 billion. But if I take his critics at face value, and I don't argue the numbers, and I can, but I don't, face value, I take the critics at their word. Do you know how much it costs? It will take 1 to 3 years longer than it would have to double our global wealth. This is the sacrifice that we are being asked to bear, and we are being told is too much to bear. We stand on the shoulders of giants. We got here because people before us took risks and made sacrifices. Far more than this, waiting 3 years to double your global income. Oh my goodness, how inconvenient, sir. We owe it to previous people to do this thing. It is not too expensive. Because once you get past the first level of denial, we say it's not true, you get to sort of the skeptic who wants more evidence. You say, well, the evidence is in. And the last bastion is, the last reason is, it costs too much? No, it doesn't. Absolute nonsense. We've done much more before, and this is not a problem. I'm sure we can do this today. Thank you very much for your time. Do we take questions at all, or shall I just sit down? Please, you can't agree with everything I said, right? I mean, yeah.
You didn't mention the politicians. How do you persuade the Tea Party representatives in the House of Representatives who voted against fracking regulations, against Lieberman's bill for climate change? How do you persuade them of this?
I don't know that you would ever persuade a Tea Party adherent of the need to do this because it's so antithetical to their worldview. I think we don't have got time to waste to convince them. I think just go around them. Have the other parties win. Honestly, I think it's a tough... I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know.
How do you get this through without legislative help?
You don't. You need laws. You can't get this through without laws. That's the hard truth, I think. Yeah.
Really?
On the shoals. Now, there were two pieces there that I didn't really absorb. One was riding off the electric car.
Right.
Which you did by saying that it would just be too expensive and too dangerous and expensive to provide the electricity that's needed. So I'm wondering if there's a partial electrification option there. And then the other one was the price of carbon, which is, seems like one of the really important legs of the stool.
Yeah. Sure. So the first question is around partial electrification of transport, because I wrote off the electric car. It's true that there is a role for the electric car, because there is certainly surplus power being made at night in Ontario, because you can't turn the nukes off. So there can be some penetration of electric cars. Electric cars also play a role in distributed energy storage, so they have value. But there are other problems, even in partial penetration of electrical cars, because substations need to cool at night, and you can't put power through them. Otherwise, you got to build more substations. So there's infrastructure costs. So there is a partial, you can get partway there. But the idea that it's a magic bullet is what I poo-pooed, right? That you can't just think that's going to solve the problem. So you're right. There are benefits and partial solutions with an electric car. I'm just saying it's not a magic bullet. The other question was around the price on carbon, and you seem to think it was more complicated than putting a price on carbon, and I say no, it's not. It is a single market signal that will affect every transaction overnight. There was there's a Republican skeptic that went to China and saw the scale at which they were building windmills and solar panels and so on, and he saw the rug getting taken out of the American manufacturers. And even as a skeptic of climate change, he kind of said, well, you know, the world's going to decarbon. They're wrong, but they're going to do it anyway. He just sees it as a market. And he came back and he said, you know, I don't know that the market economy can respond quickly enough to that central command and control that China has. And the central bank, which, by the way, provides debt capital to all the Chinese exported technologies, right? Very aggressive debt project finance coming from the Chinese central bank. And he sort of said the market economy can't respond that quickly. Unless the only tool we have that could respond that quickly is a price on carbon. So even he admitted, I wish I could remember his name. It'll come to me as soon as I stop thinking about it. But he acknowledged that that's the only signal that could work quickly. And if you think about it, it's instantaneous. So it doesn't just affect. So here's my idea, right? It's the tax and dividend thing. So you collect all the money from point sources. There's not that many of them in the United States, all the nat gas plants and coal plants and so on. Oil import, oil. So it's not that many. You distribute the money. Everybody can then make their own decision about how they want to spend this new money they've got, right? If they decide to live a low-carbon life, they're richer. If they decide to live a high-carbon life, they're poorer. Every individual consumer's transactions will change. A high-carbon Mars bar will cost more than a low-carbon Mars bar. And there will be high-carbon Mars bars and low-carbon Mars bars depending on the factory. Well, some people don't like that word because it's sort of it makes people's skin crawl. But yeah, tax and dividend. Collect it at the source, distribute it right away. So that changes all the consumer behavior. And then the project finance side, like the billions of dollars that goes into energy projects, that all changes too, because there's going to be less demand for the high carbon energy output because it's going to get ultimately passed through the consumer. There's going to be less demand for it. So there's nothing as powerful as a single price signal. So I think it is that simple. Yeah, I think carbon trading will just get gamed by Wall Street. I don't think it's a good solution. No, I think once you open the can of worms about the poor, there are deep complexities about social justice, because poor people won't be able to eat their house because the carbon tax went up. So I think you need to start. And that's another reason why it's really difficult for the right to start getting hold of this issue. Because once you start talking about a carbon tax, you do have to start talking about, well, now that person can't afford to fill their car, and that person can. And you have to start dealing with issues like inequity, and if you don't like government intrusion, well, now you've opened up a massive government intrusion. So I think it's complicated. And I think you need to do things like subsidize heating bills for houses under 2,000 square feet or income, something like that. I think you need to have a full discussion about social justice. Like, you can't avoid it.
And that's what they were doing in the UK.
Yeah, it's more complicated than I let on, I admit, but yeah.
I have a question that we use this efficiency can kind of be a science on, because usually when you have market forces and efficiency, it's been proven historically that the more efficient something gets, higher consumption. And this is the real skeptical claim against trying to just rely on efficiency.
Yeah.
And it's calling to mind another Canadian, Madeline Klein,
the
shot button. You actually mean disasters to
Yeah.
We need to hit that wall.
Yeah. No, no.
Because otherwise we're just going to be alleviating symptoms.
Yeah.
But we're going to be, like, the efficiency just seems to be science off.
Yeah. No, I think you make a very good point that if you lower the, if you use less of something and have more money to spend, that you'll end up using more of it anyway. And there's a bit of a paradox. I can't remember what it's called. It has a name. The what is it?
Rebound.
The rebound effect. Well, that's why you have to have the hard conversation about price. Right? So the only way you unlock efficiency is raise the price of something. And again, it's a market signal. And you don't raise the price of something unless you've had an adult conversation about why you need to do it and you get buy-in from the electorate. That's why you have to have that hard conversation about climate change. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is a model. So there's a few initiatives in... Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a few test cases in North America. There's the Western Climate Initiative. There's local carbon taxes in Quebec, Alberta, and BC. I think it's good. It's, you know, it gets the conversation started, these regionalized carbon trading networks. I actually don't like carbon trading. I actually think it's just going to get gamed. But, you know, it's better than nothing, I guess. Is it? I think it gets a conversation started. I mean, even in Quebec and BC, they've shown that the BC carbon tax is economically beneficial. But these are little nibbles, right? These are incremental changes, and incremental change ain't going to do it. And so it's good that it starts a conversation. It's good that it gets institutional awareness in place. Financial institutions, big corporations start to build the internal capacity to understand that market. So I think it's good to send educational signals out there, but I don't think it's going to do the job we need it to do. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Europe's trying hard, right? I mean, they have their 20-20-20, so 20% reduction, 20% clean by 2020. I mean, Europe has been by far the leading light on this issue for years and years and years. I mean, they've backed off a little lately, but, you know, they actually have laws. I mean, David Buckland talked yesterday. They have laws about how much they've got to reduce their carbon. So there's lots of stuff in Europe. I don't see much here. I mean, Ontario has a Green Energy Act, which is a feed-in tariff, which I formally support. I think it's a great first move, but again, it's picking technologies, picking winners, and it's run into some opposition. So I support it as a way of, as better than nothing, but I think there's better ways to go about it. There's not much in, you know, there's this carbon tax in BC and so on. But that single stroke of Obama's pen on the transportation stuff, unless they bake in some loopholes, right? I mean, the question's going to be about loopholes. Yeah. 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 I think regulation has a role to play. You know, if you change the building code, you change everything. I mean, I have a friend who works on that stuff, and it's the most boring work I can imagine. But he's like, but when we get a win, you know? So. I think there's lots of low-hanging fruit you can get through regulations, particularly in the building trade, transportation trade, and so on. But the big one, the global one's got to be priced on carbon. And you've got to engage, like, the WTO, and you've got to engage tariffs if other countries don't play right. I mean, the institutions are there. I think you just have to get them to play the carbon game rather than the whatever game they're playing now, opening up doors. And yeah. The first question was about using the internet companies as a model. It's a good idea. People talk about that, you know, crowdsourcing and Wikipedias and stuff. This is infrastructure. These are big point sources of carbon, as the point was made yesterday. So, no, I don't have a lot of hope for this new business model that the internet, because the internet's, I mean, it's little wires, and the energy internet's big wires. And there's fundamentally different, right? One is infrastructure that requires debt capital. And again, when you go to the pump, like, that's controlled by a few companies, right? You're not going to go into the liquid fuel space as an independent and start competing with them. Like, it's just not going to happen. So we have choices given to us, and it's a limited choice. We need to change that choice. So, no, I'm a top-down kind of guy on this thing. And I didn't hear or understand the second question.
The discount rate and how we value the future. Yeah.
Right, so the argument from the other side is that the discount rate is an empirical measurement of economic activity. You pick out the long-term growth rate of the stock market or the long-term lending rates of the central banks, and you say, that's actually an empirical number that I put into my model. There's a couple problems with that. I mean, one problem is that we don't have any data or basis for thinking that that works over a 100-year time horizon. For another, things like the bank's interest rates is not something, that's something that's set based on policy decisions of central banks, right? They decide I'm fighting unemployment or I'm fighting inflation. So they're setting it for reasons. So it's not an empirical measurement of people's expectation of future value. When you go to get a mortgage and it's 7%, that doesn't mean that you're making a vote as a consumer that you think the 100-year discount rate should be 7%. It means the bank says, you give me 7%. Right? So it's not an empirical number, contrary to what Nordhaus would say. I say it's value-laden, and I agree with Nick Stern, and I think one of the things that you put into that number is the ethical treatment of future generations. But I think more practically, the question about climate, so the discount rate works if you're building a bridge, and you decide, should I build it now or should I build it later? Everything else remaining constant, or a hospital or a new factory or something. But the key is, it's a global variable, and I'm changing a local piece. I'm making a decision about this. The problem with climate change is that it's systemic. It affects everything. So Nick Stern's point was, well, the discount rate should be negative because they're going to be poorer 50 years from now. You can't assume they're going to keep growing. This, you know. So that's, I think, philosophically a problem for using a discount rate to make decisions about independent projects, right? It's a global variable, and climate change changes that. It doesn't just change local stuff. So I think there's a number, and there's lots of debate around in the literature, but those are, I think, the high points. Yeah. That's a very good question. So the question is, if you price carbon here, you're handing an advantage to China. It's a race to the bottom. All the high carbon industries move to China, roughly. I think that's absolutely valid. That's why one of the hardest things about this problem is the degree of cooperation we need to have. Now, my solution to that is, well, we've got institutions in place like the WTO and GATT and a bunch of other things that govern international trade. Let's just be willing to call it a carbon tariff. And if country A has a carbon price of $50 and country B has a carbon price of $10 or zero, then there's going to be a measurement of the carbon in that product, and there's going to be a tax put on that product as it comes across the water. And ideally, there's going to be a tax on the fuel in the boat that brings it across the water. So I think we need, the institutions are there. I think we just need to get them focused on carbon as a tariff to enforce a level playing field. But that's, you've hit the nail on the head. This is, how do you get everybody to play fair at the same time? Yeah, it's tough. Yeah.
One is when you burst into palm and the
Yeah.
How many acres is it?
Yeah. So the question is, you know, when I said there's a map of Texas the size of your palm, and you put a solar farm in the size of your thumbnail, how many acres is the thumbnail? Yes. I don't know. Really good question. So the question is around, as I take it, some implicit subsidies for fossil fuels and keeping supply lines open and standing armies to protect them. I think that is something that needs to be talked about. The U.S. military budget is $1 trillion a year. How much of that could you lose if you didn't have to protect supply lines and threaten countries that don't play nice and invade Iraq and so on? I think it's a huge amount. I don't know what the number is. I'm not a military expert, but I bet it's a lot. And there's wars of aggression where you go and get the oil. So no, I think that needs to be on the table. I mean, this, you know, when clean energy says, hey, you know what, I need some training wheels, give me some subsidies, maybe a price on carbon, it's treated like, you know, wow, you really want a lot of help. You know, that's a little unfair. Every industry has had training wheels, from nuclear to aviation to the internet to pharmaceuticals. They all have it. Fossil fuels has more than any of them because it's one of the only ones that requires a standing military to protect its supply lines. So I think that needs to be on the table. Look, absent climate change, I would argue that fracking for natural gas can be positioned as energy security. Of course it can. But we are not absent climate change. And I think climate change is a national security issue. The Pentagon has acknowledged it's the big one for them. I mean, they've put out a bunch of reports that have talked about how hard their job is going to be if this thing gets out of control. So I think the national security issue is climate change, not energy, to be honest. Yes. Yeah, no, there are. Nothing's free. Hydro, you flood stuff. Geothermal, the deep geo, you frack it. There's been little earthquakes. Tidal, you change the moves of the tide if you take enough out of it. Wind, some people don't like looking at them. It's industrial blight on the landscape. These are all reasonable arguments. It's cost benefit. It's one risk against another. And I think those arguments, as long as we're transparent and we're reasonable and we have a good debate, we'll do a good risk-adjusted analysis of all these projects. But I just don't think the debate is being done in good faith, because I do think that the big risk that's being ignored is climate change. You know, but nothing's free. I mean, there's no easy answer to any of this stuff. So I agree. There are costs to solar. There's costs to geo. There's costs to it all. So the cost per, you're asking the financial cost?
No,
the well, it depends where you put it. If you put it on top of an endangered turtle's nest, then it's endangered. I don't know. I mean, it depends on where you put it.
Well, depends where you put it. Manufacturing of the solar cells, too, isn't it? I mean, I've heard horror stories about Chinese plants dumping awful stuff into the soil.
Sure.
And, you know, the backward places where businesses don't have the guns and money and lawyers to have.
This is industrial equipment. I mean, you know, these are industrial things. It's industrial factories. It has the same concerns of any other industry in terms of manufacturing safely, in terms of building stuff, and what are the environmental costs of building that stuff. It's the same as any other infrastructure. I think all you want is a conversation about what risks are on the other side. And, you know, I don't think we're having that conversation. But your point is well taken. I agree. Well, I don't know what the environmental costs are, so it depends where you put it. Yes.
Yeah. Buildings that leave air conditioning on overnight, and a part of that problem is because fuel for us has been very cheap, it's been subsidized, and we've become a very wasteful society. So the thing that is free, absolutely free, is using less. And, I think that we need, during World War II, we had use it up, wear it out, make it do or do it better, a national campaign to find out that we actually can live quite comfortably if we just stop wasting. Yeah. That knocks 50% off the cost of your infrastructure right there.
Yeah.
I can say personally that I use a very small home solar system. You know, this idea that it's going to take a $30,000 solar system to run your house. Yes, if you're a regular American
wasteful person and you run all the crap that everybody runs that's ridiculous, yes, it's going to cost $30,000, but if you just run the basic things you need and maximize efficiency, I can tell you how to make a chest freezer refrigerator that burns a tenth of the amount of your Energy Star refrigerator. You can use $1,000 worth of solar and run everything that you need. So all I'm trying to say is if there were just a campaign to maximize efficiency and reduce waste, we could knock a lot off of the cost of the infrastructure.
Yes, I absolutely agree. So the point is that if there was an information campaign and knowledge about the effectiveness of efficiency, things would change. Yeah, but not everyone cares, right? Most people are taking their kids to hockey, watching movies, wondering who's going to win the next dance thing or whatever. So the only way you're going to unlock, and again, the only way you're going to unlock that efficiency is a price signal.
You're right.
Right?
But it's cheaper,
I think,
for people to use less.
Yeah, absolutely. No, agreed.
And we all agree here that legislation is really going to be hard because our politicians are bond made for by corporations who depend on us to consume. After 9/11, Bush told us to go shopping, not to use it up, wear it out, do that, and get off our oil.
Yeah.
So we're all used to this lifestyle of waste.
The irony is that efficiency is the easiest thing to do, but the hardest thing to make happen. Right? It is the cheapest source of energy is efficiency. It is the lowest cost infrastructure in terms of putting in stuff to reduce energy. It's easy to do, but it's hard to make people do it because it needs a higher price on the energy. The irony is, it's the easiest thing and the hardest thing at the same time. So efficiency is this real hard nut to crack. I mean, there's little gaps, right? So every building above a certain size pays money in a cooling tower to get rid of heat. Well, there's a company in Canada that has figured out how to extract at a reasonable efficiency from low-grade waste heat, so under 100 degrees Celsius, so 80 degrees Celsius, turn it into electricity. So now you're going to go to those big buildings and say, instead of paying a dollar to get rid of your heat, you're going to make a dollar putting electricity back into your building. So you just the answer is you just have to work really hard to go and convince people that you're going to do something in your benefit. Instead of having every homeowner go through all these decisions about how do I retrofit and what do I do, just have a massive municipal bond, and it's called an ESCO model, where an energy company goes in and says to you, the homeowner, I'm going to come in and I'm going to redo your house. You'll approve everything, but I'm going to do it all. I'm going to figure it all out. You get half the savings. I get half the savings. Done. Right? So there you don't have to make decisions. So there's models to do this, but I agree. There's no question that efficiency is there's no reasonable analysis of future energy trends where carbon gets reduced, where at least half of that reduction doesn't come from efficiency, assumed efficiencies. None of them.
All of this needs to be done at once.
Yep.
And the public is primed to do something. We all want to do something. We don't want to walk out this door after this weekend and do nothing. So it seems like if we had an impetus to go home and just, because we are all members of society, but we're all individuals and we're a group. So we could make all these changes at once. We can lobby for anti-mountain removal mining and all that stuff, all at the same time. We have to do it all. Because, like you said, it has to be done over.
Yep. Hear, hear. We have to do it all. David.
Amy called me yesterday and said, you know, it's lovely to think about making the atmosphere well prepared to site. That implies a price on carbon.
Yeah, it does.
How do you sell it? I mean, it is potentially a very interesting way of selling the idea that you actually have a price polluting.
Yeah, I like. Yeah. So
the
notion of the atmosphere as a World Heritage Site. This is one of those ideas where you get around people's defenses, right? So you sort of get someone to understand and think about the atmosphere in a new way, and whether or not it's going to be effective from a legal position, I don't know. I think everybody should ignore it. But in terms of having people reimagine what the atmosphere is, I think it's a brilliant idea. And again, it's one of these things that kind of sneaks up behind you and like taps you on the back of the head. You say, oh, yeah, that's true. And once you go there, then you think harder about pollution and all the rest of it. So I think those are really effective ways of getting the average Joe who doesn't think about this stuff to think about this stuff, because it's an idea that already resonates, I think. Thanks a lot, everybody. You've been very patient.